tea time. Yeah. Making a difference. One cup at a time. Tea time. So be sure to grab your tea, grab a seat, and tune in to Miss Liz. Tea time. Making a difference. One cup at a time.
Well, welcome to Tea Time. Miss Liz is back, and it is a new week, and we have two TEAs coming in today on this amazing Thursday. We are closing up February. Can you believe we're already going into March? If you haven't subscribed to Miss Liz's YouTube channel, run over, click that little bell, and subscribe to Tea Time. You can watch these tea times at any time in your home, in your car, in your office, at work. Tea Time is for everyone out there. So today I am joined with the incredible Jimmy Fritz, and he'll be coming in, and we're going to be talking about his books, his music, films. We're going to be talking about a lot of stuff, but before we do all of that, we're going to get the disclaimer in and a little bio on Jimmy Fritz, and then we're going to get Jimmy in here, and we're going to spill a good strong cup of tea with all of you guys this afternoon. The disclaimer for Miss Liz's Tea Time live show. Miss Liz, myself, is going live using StreamYard. Before leaving a comment, please grant StreamYard permission to see your name at StreamYard.com. Please be advised that the content brought forward for any Tea Time show hosted by myself, Miss Liz, is always brought forward in good faith. However, it may bring forward dialogues and opinions that are not representative of my platform. The facts and information are perceived to be accurate at the given time of airing. All Tea Time guests and the audience participants are responsible for using their good judgment in taking any action that may relate to the discussion. The content brought forward may include discussions for some where they may be emotionally at risk. It is significant to know that this show is engaging in discussion forums only to offer and inspire awareness and connection, and is not providing therapeutical advice. If you have any questions about the disclaimer or the panelist discussion, you may freely contact me, Miss Liz, through my email at bookingmissliz@gmail.com. Moving forward, should you choose to voluntarily participate in today's show in any aspect, I myself, Miss Liz, welcomes you. And should you decide that the show is not made for you at this time, I respect those wishes and will see you at a later show at a later date and time. And again, all Tea Time shows are done on Thursday, 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, unless it is a rescheduled tea time or a returning guest coming back, which will be done on a Monday or Tuesday. Now, a little bit on my guests. Jimmy Fritz is a British-Canadian writer, musician, filmmaker, and a bon vivant. He has written two feature-length screenplays, numerous articles, and three books. His first book, Rave Culture, An Insider Overview, chronicled the global rave phenomenon. In 2020, he published Confessions of an Ecstatic Drug Dealer, a psychedelic travelogue and memoir, and a witty and enlightening tragedy of the responsible using of psychedelics told through the lens of a 50-year journey buying, selling, and consuming psychedelic drugs. Most recently, Fritz has completed a new novel entitled The Ends of Everything, about a character named Fritz who is plotting his own suicide in a mental asylum. It's an ironic black comedy. As a singer-songwriter, he has produced 5 albums and 24 music videos of his original songs. As a filmmaker, he has also produced and directed numerous shorts and documentaries. So let me get Jimmy in here, and we can spill some tea together. Welcome, Jimmy.
Hi. Greetings from sunny British Columbia.
Did I get any of those words mixed up?
You got almost every other word mispronounced, yeah.
Well,
it was astounding, the amount of mistakes in that, like, almost every other word was mispronounced. But we can correct them at a later date, perhaps.
So, Jimmy, let's start off with who you were as a little guy and who you are now as a grown guy.
Who I was as a little guy?
Yeah, who were you as a little guy?
Oh, I was a little English schoolboy with a pair of shorts and a cap. And I was grew up in Crawley, Sussex, England, and went to one of the worst schools of the world. It was a school for demented teachers. And I was tortured and beaten for 4 or 6 years, and then got the hell out of there and never went back. That was my schooling in a nutshell.
So who are you now as a grown guy?
Me, I'm a self-actualized, successful entrepreneur and creator. And a hell of a funny guy.
You got that black sense of humor, which I like. You remind me of my uncle, my Uncle Chris from the UK. So, Jimmy, I want to get into, how did you get into writing, screenwriting?
Well, I went to film school. I decided I wanted to be a director. So I went to, you know, I was a film buff for a long time. I was always into lots of cinema, auteur cinema mostly. And I decided I wanted to make films. So I went to film school. And one of the things we did at film school was screenwriting. So I wrote some screenplays there and later on wrote some more. And then quickly figured out that I did make a bunch of films. I did a bunch of documentaries. I did a bunch of, educationals, promotional stuff like that. I was working my way up to a feature film. I made some shorts and documentaries were fun, but got to the point where you're with feature filmmaking, it's so expensive and it's such a long process. You know, it literally takes years and years of your life. And so I eventually gave that up and thought, well, I'll write, because when you write, you can do anything you want. You know, you can go to Mars and back if you want. You can do, you know, any type of scenario you like. And there's really no limits. Whereas film is kind of, it's very limited by the partners you have to have and by everybody, you know, what has an opinion. And it's very difficult to get projects funded. It's a little bit easier these days, I think. But, you know, when I started, I was doing it 30 years ago, it was much more difficult. There were very few funding sources. There were very few production partners and exhibitors and whatnot. You had to kind of get into a theater to make any money. And now it's a whole different ballgame. So it has opened up quite a bit. I mean, there's been, in the last 10 to 15 years with streaming, there's been just an avalanche, just an explosion of productions, which is good, which is great.
So, Jimmy, how long did you go to school for filmmaking?
I think it was a one year course. It was 1 year intensive, so to like 3 or 4 days a week, and then we did other shoots and stuff on weekends. And did a little bit of everything. You know, it was just a kind of an overall course, which is exactly what I got what I wanted out of it. Many people didn't, because they were looking for jobs in the film industry, and I was just looking at the whole process from start to finish. So I got a smattering of all of that, and so it was good for me. And I went straight into making a TV show at a local cable company right after film school, which was also a great training ground. So, it was fun. I mean, filmmaking is great fun. I loved it, but it's very, very expensive and problematic in organizational things. And to actually get films made is very, very difficult. And then to get them seen is even more difficult. I'm finding the same with books these days. I mean, I'm writing the books that I want to write, which is great. But then to sell it, you're competing with millions of books, you know, on the internet, and who's going to find you, you know, unless they actually search your name or whatever. It's very, very difficult to punch through that, this vortex of product on this. And now we have AI books being uploaded. There's thousands of AI books being uploaded to Amazon every single day.
Yeah,
that's a massive problem, because you know, they're just books that are culled from other books. Everything's stolen. And it's just cobbled together. Nobody knows the difference between a real book and a fake book. But the market is flooded with them now. And there'll be more and more and more and more until there's more fake books than real books.
Well, it seems like they're burying, right? They're burying the real stuff.
Yeah, exactly. It's just buried in this avalanche of false products. And that goes the same with art and writing, movies and videos and all this stuff. There's so much fake stuff out there now. People really can't tell the difference. I mean, even before AI, people were, you know, could barely tell the difference between real art and fake art.
Yeah.
And now it's even more difficult. So, what we're experiencing right now, what we're seeing is the death of art and culture. We're seeing lots of the art forms just fall away. and they'll disappear. And then our whole creative world will be run by robots. Won't that be fun?
Yeah. Well, Jimmy, I want to get into the psychedelic drugs, because that's almost like another world, right? When you're on those drugs.
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, it doesn't. It's actually the same world, seen through a different lens. So it's very tempting to look at the psychedelic experience as, you know, going somewhere else or entering another dimension, or you know, there's lots of talk about, you know, going to different dimensions of reality. And I don't think that's true. I think it just makes your brain work in a different way. And I think it can be really useful and really interesting and really fascinating and great for creativity and problem solving and all these other things. I think a lot of really great applications. But no, I don't think we spin off into the fourth dimension and time travel and, you know, have tea with ayahuasca machine elves.
The reason that I ask that is because you don't like the AI.
Oh, you just cracked up and I can't hear what you're saying.
Oh, so it's like the AI, right? It's like another dimension. So like a lot of people have this misinformation that psychedelic drugs is like rainbows and fancy, you know, like all these sparkly little gems and stuff like that. So I want to get into the misinformation of psychedelic drugs, like, because you brought in some really interesting things: creativity, problem solving, information, you know. A lot of people don't talk about that, that side of the drug.
Well, everybody wants to talk about the therapeutic use now. You know, this is the hottest topic. It's psychedelic psychopharmacology or psychedelic psychotherapy. These types of applications, where they're being tested for anxiety disorder and depression and PTSD and all these other things. So the research is very, very young right now. There isn't a lot of real solid, you know, data yet. I've no doubt that there will be applications, there will be medical applications for psychedelics. And, you know, there's already the MDMA, for instance, is already, it's just on the verge of being completely legalized as a prescription medication for PTSD, because they've been testing it for 25 years now. And they're getting fantastic results with that. So it looks like that's gonna be a real option for PTSD. But my interest in psychedelics is not therapeutic. I've never done them therapeutically, because I don't think I've ever needed therapy. But no, I do them recreationally, and I do them to expand. I do them to make the world more interesting and to make my own brain more interesting and to, you know, enhance my creativity. They've certainly done that. Certainly opened my mind to lots of other possibilities and philosophical ideas and, you know, solve problems and all this. So for me, there's been nothing but, you know, I've been using psychedelics for 50 years. And there's been nothing but positive results, nothing but benefits. So that was part of the reason for writing Confessions of an Ethical Drug Dealer by Jimmy Fritz, available at fine bookstores everywhere and through my website at jimmyfritz.ca. And one of the reasons for writing that was to just give an example of a life that has been intertwined and interconnected with psychedelic drug use for 50 years, and there's been nothing but benefits. And that's the side of the story that that we, you know, we don't hear a lot of. We hear about drug problems, and we hear about the therapeutic, you know, medical uses of drugs. But really, it's just enhanced and improved the quality of my life. And that's the experience that most of the people that I've, you know, come across in the last 50 years, which is a lot of people, it's mostly their experience too. I mean, that's the common experience, but that's the one, that's the part of it that we don't hear too much about.
So Jimmy, you've been doing this for over 50 years. So over those 50 years, have you seen a change in the drugs?
Well, there's a few new ones, you know. There's a few new ones coming about, but the old favorites, the old standards are still good. LSD still works just fine, just as well as it did in the 60s. And, you know, The drugs don't change. I mean, LSD is LSD. It's a specific molecule, and if it is, it is, and if it isn't, it isn't. But there's been a bunch of new ones. There was a research chemist called Alexander Shulgin, who worked for the Dow Chemical Corporation, and they gave him free rein to do research. And he was interested in benzene rings, which is the basis of psychedelics. And he invented at least 300 unique psychedelic compounds, including things like 2CB and 2CT and 2C4B and, blah, blah, blah. There's all these the veritable alphabet soup of new chemicals that he tested, and he tested them on himself and his wife, but most of them have never really been tested any outside of his himself and his wife. So, they haven't really been looked up, but because they were psychedelics, everything was immediately scheduled. So all these potentially useful or interesting drugs have all been scheduled, as illegal. So once they're illegal, you can't do much testing, which is why there hasn't been much testing on psychedelic drugs in the last 50 years, because they've been illegal. So nobody can really, get hold of them or see what they're good for. Now that's changing. There's more and more legalization, and as they don't become legalized, they can be studied. And I'm sure we'll find out all kinds of new things about them.
Well, you said that some of them were being used for PTSD. Do you use them for PTSD, Jimmy?
Do I?
Yeah.
No, I've never had PTSD.
Do you know anybody that?
I use MDMA to enjoy house music.
House music. So what is house music?
and to dance the night away. That's what I use it for, and it's very good for that. It's been well tested in the field.
So Jimmy, what is house music to you?
What is house music?
Yeah.
That's a form of electronic dance music that evolved from disco originally. So disco kind of went, there was the Disco Sucks campaign, and disco sort of went underground. And when it went underground, it went into the gay clubs, and it became new style disco. Oh. And new style disco was mixing tracks together and doing these extended mixes and dropping out the vocals. And that became house music, which happened in Chicago. And then it migrated to Detroit and became techno. They put more techno sounds in it, more, drum machines and whatnot. And then those two forms eventually branched out into all the electronic dance music forms we have today, which are many and varied.
So Jimmy, we have a question here for you. When you're on yourself, experiencing a psychedelic experience, when you're on the drug, do you do your writing then?
No.
Okay.
No, I can't write on, can't write high on anything. Whoops, just a second. I'll just skip that. I can't write or play music really when I'm, if I'm high. Because I need to be able to concentrate. And it's a much more fluid. You can get good ideas. I mean, I think about writing when I'm on, if I'm on a psychedelic, I might think about writing. I might think about music. I might have some ideas, some different kinds of ideas, which makes you think in different ways, right? So you might have ideas that you wouldn't normally have. And then I can apply those to music or writing or filmmaking or whatever it is when I'm not high.
So, Jimmy, what came first, the filmmaking or the music?
Music. The music. I started playing guitar. So I was touring around Europe as a teenager touring around the Mediterranean. And I used to go from town to town and play the guitar and harmonica in the cafes. And I used to make a pretty good living doing that. And I did it for several years, 3 or 4 years. And that was like 17 at the time. So music came first. Movie making was quite a while after that.
So what was the first instrument you learned how to play?
Guitar.
Guitar?
Yeah, I was in a campsite and some guy with a guitar came up and he was playing a lot of songs that I knew, and he couldn't sing and I couldn't play. So I sang and he played. And then three days later, I bought my first guitar and that was in Florence. And then I went down to hitchhike down to Rome, and I was playing on the streets of Rome within 3 days. I learned three songs, and I played the same three songs over and over again, stood on the street, and people put money in the hat, and I thought, this is fantastic. I can do this forever. I'll never need another job. And it's pretty much how it worked out. I never really had a regular job.
So, Jimmy, how did you get to Canada?
How did I get to Canada? I was trying to get to the States, and I applied for a visa, and they said, forget it. Don't try again. So that was that. And I was actually hitchhiking in England. I got picked up by a folk singer, a Canadian folk singer from Ontario. And he picked me up, and I ran around with him for about a week in England while he was visiting. And he said, we should come to Toronto, and you can stay at my place, and blah, blah, blah. So I'd never barely even heard of Canada before. But I got on a plane about 3 weeks later. I arrived at his doorstep, and that was my first. That was in like 1977.
Oh,
so then I was here for a couple of years at that point, and then I got arrested as an illegal immigrant, thrown into jail, kicked out of the country, went back to England, applied to come back, and that took many years. But eventually, I did get back, and I did get a passport. Now I have a Canadian passport.
So you're a full Canadian.
Yeah. Eventually. They tried everything they could to keep me out. Every time I went to another interview, they'd bring out the phone book size file and go through it, humming and hawing. And they did everything they could to, wait another 6 months, and now you've got to rehabilitate yourself, and now you've got to do this, that, and the other thing. And this went on for about 7 years. And I think the game is that they wear you down and you go away. That's that's the general plan of action. But I didn't go away. We just stuck in. Plus, I married a Canadian citizen on the way to court. I got arrested, got out on bail, ran to the city hall, got married to a Canadian citizen, and then went back to the court case. And we're still married today. It was a spur of the moment passport marriage at the time, but we've been together now for 45 years. We just celebrated our 45th anniversary.
Congratulations.
Yeah, take that, immigration.
I'm stuck here for and some of those courthouse weddings, they lasted a long time, like 45 years. Congratulations.
That's
on
right
that.
Yeah, well, that was part of our problem, was that it was so obviously a passport marriage. It was obviously a quick job on the way to the court. He's got married 20 minutes ago, Your Honor. They went, oh, yeah, that sounds legit. So that kind of was a big, big strike against us. That was a big, big dent in our credibility. But, ironically, 45 years later, here we are.
You just never know, right? Go to the courthouse.
I'd love to find that judge again now.
And what have you learned about yourself in 45 years?
God, everything.
Yeah.
There's nothing left to learn. No, I've pretty much thoroughly explored every aspect of who I am, and I'm very comfortable with who I am, and I don't need, I don't need therapy. I don't need improvement. I don't need to change anything. I'm just, completely content with my life the way it is.
Oh, I love that.
Pretty much always have been. If I think back at even my early teenage traveling years, it was like I was fine with everything.
And I think that's what we need, right? We need to be comfortable in our own shoes and say, this is who we are, and tit for tat, right? Take it or leave it.
You got to be who you are. And that's a big part of this big part of the life game here on planet Earth is we're not all the same person. We don't all think the same, but you have to figure out who you are, and then you have to be true to that, right? You can't be somebody else. You can't try to, you might want to be, you might think that they have a better time than you, or they have a better life or whatever, but you can't be someone else. So, your job is to be who you are.
Yeah.
And sooner you get to that point, the better, because you'll have an easier life. And I've had a very easy life.
Jimmy, I want to get into your tea. You gave me tall, accelerate. Did I say it right? Accelerate?
Eclectic.
Eclectic. I see. I didn't even get it right. Eclectic and adventurous. Why did you give me those three words, Jimmy?
What was the first one?
Tall.
Tall. Well, I'm 6 foot two and a half. Actually, I used to be 6 foot four, and I've lost an inch and three quarters in the last 25 years.
Oh.
So I'm gradually shrinking. So I guess tall is because I'm just hanging on to that last vestiges of my tallness, which is now dwindling as I shrink and become an old dwarf.
I kind of figured it had to do with your height, because I've never gotten the word tall before. And I was like, oh, that's an interesting
word. There you go. It's kind of an obvious one. What was the next one? Eclectic.
Eclectic.
Yeah, eclectic. I've done a lot of different things, and I'm interested in a lot of different things and a lot of different areas. So I think eclectic would be one of the words that could describe me.
And then
what was the last one? Adventurous. Yeah. Well, I've done a lot of adventurous things, been to a lot of, you know, different places and done some crazy stuff, and had a very exciting, adventurous life.
So what's the most adventurous thing you've ever done, Jimmy?
The most adventurous thing.
he's going to, oh boy, she's going to get me.
I don't know. Well, while the writing of my book, Confessions of an Ethical Drug Dealer by Jimmy Fritz, available at fine bookstores everywhere, jimmyfritz.ca, that's jimmyfritz.ca. While writing this book, it was basically a series of events, you know, a series of life events that I look back on, you know, which were the most adventurous and which were the most interesting. And also my criteria was which ones were linked with psychedelic experiences. So the problem was, it's like there were so many. I started making lists and said, well, I can't put all this, otherwise the whole book would just be lists, you know. So I had to kind of really pare it down, and it was it was quite a eye opener to look at all the things. I mean, I've skipped whole countries and years of time, but it's still sort of action packed. So yeah. And then there's the memory problem, you know, there's lots of things that I probably did 40, 50 years ago that can't really remember anymore. I might have forgotten whole countries by now. So there's that. So yeah, there might be too many to come up with one most adventurous.
I want to get into some of the words that you gave me before we went live, Jimmy, because I never heard half of those words that you gave me. But the word that you gave me to describe yourself was heterodoctical. I think that's how you say it. I'm not sure. I know I'm not saying it right.
Heterodoxical.
So you want to tell me what that word means? Because I've never heard that word before.
Heterodoxical is the opposite of orthodoxical.
Okay.
So an orthodoxy is sort of the status quo or the accepted norms. You know, an orthodoxy is the way that most people understand something. Heterodoxical is going against the orthodoxy. So it's having alternative views.
Oh, I just learned something new. I've never heard the word before, and I was like, I always love learning from my guests because, you know, you just never know what's out there. You also gave me a bunch of other words that you said that you use for your book. Can we get into some of those words?
Well, on the back of this book, which is Confessions of an Ethical Drug Dealer by Jimmy Fritz, it says about the author, Jimmy Fritz is a heterodoxical polemicist, a skeptical polymath, an iconoclastic anti-theist, and an aficionado of Stoicism. So that's, that's a description of my various facets, I guess. So, questions.
So give me a little bit of examples of some of those words that you have on the back of your cover.
Well, heterodoxical we've covered. Polemicist, that's somebody that argues from a side of an argument. So they take a side in an argument and then make arguments from that position.
Oh.
So that's a polemicist, which I'm good at doing. Skeptical, skeptical. Just means that, you know, I question a lot of things. I don't take things at face value. Be more likely to think, you know, my first question when somebody tells me something is, I wonder if that's true. You know, and sometimes it might be and sometimes it might not be. But just because people say things doesn't make it true.
Right.
Just because people believe things doesn't make it true. So that's skeptical. Polymath, somebody that, you know, is interesting and adept at a lot of different disciplines. So, you know, I'm a musician and a writer and an artist, and I can build things and organize and blah, blah, blah. So I've got a lot of different skills in a lot of different areas. So not, you know, not a specialist. I haven't been studying physics for the last 35 years, for instance. Iconoclastic anti-theist. Iconoclastic is somebody that that smashes the icons, you know, the things that we hold to be sacred and true. I like to question those with my skepticism, and sometimes blast them out of existence, which is iconoclasm. An anti-theist is not. I'm also an atheist. But I'm more than an atheist. I'm an anti-theist, which means that even if it was true, even if the Old Testament God, Yahweh, was a fact, I would be part of the resistance. Because I think there are, you know, a few characters in all of fiction who are more psychopathic and petty-minded and jealous and, well, basically, you know, all the worst human qualities you could ever imagine are bestowed upon Yahweh, the Old Testament God. So I would lead the resistance against that idea. Not that I believe it's true, but even if it was true, I'd be against it. And an aficionado of Stoicism. Stoicism is a Greek philosophy that was that got everything right 1,000 years before Christ.
See, and this is what we do on Tea Time. We educate.
There you go.
Right? And all the listeners out there, they're learning as much, you know, because sometimes we need that. We need that uniqueness and different. So, Jimmy, do you consider yourself a rebel?
Yeah, I guess so. I'm certainly not, you know, a run-of-the-mill, ordinary, 9-to-5 worker or whatever. Like I say, I've never really had a regular job. I've always been one scam ahead of a job, or, you know, I've always worked for myself in some way. So I've always kind of, yeah, I've always lived outside of the regular norms of society and managed to skirt a lot of those problems. I couldn't lead a conventional life. You know, it was never an option for me to knuckle down to a 9-to-5 and be conventional. It was just something I couldn't do. It wasn't in my nature. So it wasn't that I rebelled against it per se. It was just that I was unable to lead that type of a life. So I had to look for alternatives. So I always did, and it always worked out just fine.
So Jimmy, I want to get into the next book that you did. Your most recent book that you, At the End of Everything.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that book a bit.
Okay. The End of Everything by Jimmy Fritz. Available at fine bookstores everywhere and through my website at jimmyfritz.ca. That's jimmyfritz.ca. This is an ironic black comedy. It's about a character called Fritz who's plotting his own suicide in a mental asylum. And it's a sort of an homage to 19th century Russian literature, which I'm a big fan of. You know, we get these mysterious situations and characters, and they're stuck in situations that they deal with, and they have to get their psychology around and make sense of, and they react against, and they question, and, you know, this whole, it's a sort of a tradition in Russian literature to drop characters into these possible situations and then watch them try and get out. So it's kind of an homage to that. Some of the language and the writing is an homage to Russian literature.
So is that like a heavy, deep writing?
No, it's hilarious.
So it's that black comedy.
It's a black comedy. Yes, about it's about, you know, the destruction of it's about the death of art and culture, and somebody plotting their own suicide in a mental asylum, and it's hilarious.
Well, and let's talk about that, Jimmy. You know, you wrote about plotting your own suicide. So, in the book, do you write on how you're trying to commit suicide, or?
Oh yeah, it's a how-to manual on self-suicide, which is something I've thought a lot about, which is something I intend to do at some time. Not in the near future, but when the time comes, when my life is no longer, you know, tenable, or when it's no longer able to lead a full life, then I'm going to take myself out. Luckily, in Canada now, we have medically assisted suicide, which is a legal procedure that you can have done by a doctor. So I'll do that. But if they won't do it, or if I don't qualify for some reason, then I'm prepared to do it myself. So before assisted suicide was legal in Canada, I did do quite a bit of research and came up with a number of good methods, which are all outlined in the book.
So is this book meant to be a comedy, or is it meant to be an awareness?
It's meant to amuse me, I think. You know, the whole point of writing it was to amuse me. And I was well amused. And, you know, it made me laugh. I did send it to one publisher, and they said, you know, it's about a guy committing suicide in a mental asylum. And I said, but don't worry, it's hilarious. And she wrote back and said, you must have a different sense of humor than I do. And that's probably true. So
how long did it take you to write that book, Jim?
About 8 months to write it, and then a few more months, 2 or 3, to edit and publish.
So how do you feel about the Canadian law for assisted suicide?
Oh, I think it's excellent. I think it's wonderful. I think it should be available to anybody that wants it, for whatever reason they want it for. I mean, you know, they have to have, you know, pretty strict regulations in place. So they have loosened them up already, actually, because it used to be, you know, when the law first came out, you had to have a terminal disease. Well, you don't have to have a terminal disease anymore. You can just have intolerable suffering, which is, you know, and because it's patient driven, that's whatever you consider to be intolerable suffering. So if you think that your life is intolerable and you want out, then you can get it, which I think is fantastic.
It's available.
Broke up again.
Oh, did you lose me?
I lost that last sentence. Yeah.
I said it's a topic that is not really spoken about, is a suicide assistant suicide in Canada, right?
Oh, I don't know. Everybody's talking about it here. There's conversations all the time. I know several people that have done it already. I had somebody commit suicide in my gazebo in the backyard about a month ago.
Wow.
There's a friend of mine who was 92, and, you know, he was a good friend, and he come to the end of his life, and he didn't, you know, he could see the end, you know, he could see that the last probably maybe year or two or whatever he had, he could see that was going to be difficult. You know, he just about lost his mobility. He was just about losing his mind, and he was aware of those things, and he just didn't want to do that last, you know, horrible bit to the grave. So he chose to, and I told him about my plan, because I said, well, my plan is, you know, I'm going to have a big party at my house. I'm going to have all my friends, and we're going to have a beautiful gazebo in the backyard, and it's all lit up with psychedelic lighting and stuff. So I said, I'm going to have a big party. And then in the morning, I'm going to get the nurse practitioner or the doctor to come over and shoot me up. And I'm going to go out on the bench, you know, in the gazebo. And he said, well, that sounds great. Maybe I'll do that. I said, okay. So he did it. And we had the big party, and all his family came. It was wonderful closure. There was lots of events and potlucks and breakfasts. And his family came from all over. And he said goodbye to everybody. And we all gathered in the gazebo in the morning. And the doctor came over and shot him up. And he went out like a light. It just was absolutely perfectly peaceful and quick and easy and painless. And he just went to sleep, and that was it. And then we laid him out, and we had a party. So we drank, he was Irish, so we drank Irish whiskey and had a real wake with the buddy for a couple of hours. And then, you know, we came and took him away, and that was that. But it was just a perfect, it was just a perfect ending. So that's what I would hope for myself and anybody else, really. Rather than, you know, going out slowly and in pain and drugged, and because that last bit is not that great.
Yeah. I do see where you're coming from, because at the end it is painful, right? It is a struggle and, you know,
torture. And if it's not painful, it's because you've been doing so many opiates and painkillers that you don't feel pain, but then you're a zombie, you know. You're out of it. Your quality of life is gone. And when it's gone, and there's no way that you're going to turn it around and get it back, you might as well go, you know, bow out gracefully.
So, Jimmy, what message do you have for other drug dealers out there that have been misinformed about psychedelic drugs?
Misinformed?
Yeah.
Well, you see, the reason my book is called Confessions of an Ethical Drug Dealer by Jimmy Fritz, available in fine bookstores everywhere, is because I only dealt drugs that I thought were good for people. Like, I've never dealt any drugs or sold any drugs that were you know, addictive, like the opiates or crack or heroin or, you know, any of that stuff. Only the psychedelics, which I consider to be, you know, a completely different class of drugs. Most people do opiates and crack and cocaine. They do it as an escape. They do it to escape from themselves or their lives. And especially in the case of the, you know, hardcore opiate addicts in the street or whatever. These guys are, you know, they're suffering from trauma and they have horrible backgrounds and they hate themselves and they hate their lives. But they do these drugs to self-medicate. So that's nothing to do with anything that I've ever done. What I advocate is the use of drugs that get you into it rather than get you out of it. So my, you know, the psychedelics engage you in your life. They amplify your life and improve and enhance the quality of your life. Whereas the other drugs, I call it dumb drugs and smart drugs. So the dumb drugs decrease your perception and awareness and give you an escape from your problems. The smart drugs actually improve and enhance the quality of your life. And therefore, you know, make things better. So if you use them responsibly. So that's another thing I've always done, is advocated responsible drug use. And if you do the psychedelics responsibly, it can make your life just a lot more interesting, with no downside, no side effects.
And you just said something really, really amazing, Jimmy, is responsible, right? Being responsible, not
right.
Overindulging in anything, right? If you overeat, you get, you know, obesity. Yeah. You know, like, it's the responsibility, taking the responsible choice of not overindulging in something, in anything in life.
Right. Yeah. Anything can be excessive. Anything can be overdone. And anything can be done for the wrong reasons. So, you know, if you're doing things for the right reasons and you're doing things responsibly with a perception and awareness, then you can't really go wrong.
So, Jimmy, I want to get into, I found this online, so if everybody can see, it's a cup of tea. So I want to get into the cup of tea, because I found this really interesting on your website. So do you want to talk a little bit about the how to make a cup of tea?
Well, it was actually throughout the book and Confessions of an Ethical Drug Dealer. I do a lot of traveling and I'm in a lot of different countries. And in some of those countries, I order tea, which is always a big mistake, because the way people make tea around the world and in various countries, they don't seem to have any sort of awareness or about how to make tea. Nobody ever taught them how to make tea, so they think they just put the bag in and put the water in and put the thing in and you're all good to go. The truth is far from that. So I made these references all the way through the book into getting horrible cups of tea. And then the last chapter is called an extra supplementary bonus chapter, which is how to make a perfect cup of tea. And you can also read that piece on my website at jimmyfritz.ca. And it's the last chapter in Confessions of an Ethical Drug Dealer.
I just thought that it was amazing that I found how to make a cup of tea when we're on tea time. I was like, oh, well, look at that.
Yeah.
He brings me a different type of tea.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's a lot of ways it can go wrong. There's a lot of things you can do wrong, and it can be totally disastrous. Sometimes people say to me, oh, I'll make you a cup of tea. And I go, yeah, okay, maybe. the chances of getting a good cup of tea in that situation are, you know, 0 to 5% kind of thing. It's slim.
So where's the best cup of tea made?
In my house.
We all got to go to Jimmy's house.
In my kitchen, yeah. You've got to come here because, you know, it's just a crapshoot anywhere else. I mean, typically, most English households make a decent cup of tea. You can even get a half-decent cup of tea on British Rail, which you wouldn't think was possible, but they tend to pull it off. There are certain basic principles, like boiling water, you know, which is absolutely 100% essential for a good cup of tea. And you'll find a lot of people, you know, that make tea that's off the boil, you know, stop boiling and then they use it. Very bad. Doesn't work. There's a habit in the US especially. They have no respect for tea whatsoever. And they take the water from the, those coffee pots.
Oh, yes.
So there's one of those coffee pots on top of the coffee machine, and it's half, you know, full of like this light brown water,
yeah,
which has been sitting there all day, and it hasn't boiled in ever, and so it's lifeless and flat and devoid of any sort of, you know, flavor, and they take that and then they put it in a metal teapot, and they'll pour it in the metal teapot, put the lid down, and then put the tea bag on the outside of the pot and then bring it to the table. Well, that's just a disaster in the making. That's just, there's no hope. When you see that, you know that there's no hope.
Don't even drink it.
No, you just order a glass of water and make the best of it.
Take the water and put your tea bag, have a cold tea.
Right.
So have you ever had iced tea, Jimmy?
I have. It's okay. It's a kind of a different drink. I just think of it as a different type of drink. But yeah, on a hot day, iced tea, maybe. I mean, I have had it. I wouldn't make it or think about it. But yeah, I prefer, even on a hot day, I prefer a hot cup of tea.
Yeah, I do too. I just thought it was pretty amazing that I found how to make a cup of tea for tea time with my guests. So it was really incredible. I want to get into some of your films because you have done some really incredible films, Jimmy. So do you have anything in the works coming? Or?
Yeah, well, I'm just working on a new album, which is a 27-minute track. It's a 27-minute composition made up of lots of different transitional pieces, and I got string sections in there and electric guitar and all kinds of different instrumentations. I've got about 36 different multi-tracks going right now. So that's going to be, I've got a horn player coming in on Saturday, and then we'll finish that. And then there's some bass to put on there, and then it's just mixing. So when that's done, I'm going to make a 27-minute music video to go with it. And almost nobody's going to be able to sit through that because nobody watches a 27-minute music video. But whatever. Like I say, I do these things for myself.
Well, I think it's different, Jimmy. And you never know. There might be that person out there that says, you know what? Finally, we got something that's going to go more than 3 minutes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's interesting with people's attention span. It either seems to be about, you know, 15 seconds or 15 hours. You know, because you got these streaming shows on Netflix that people binge watch, and they'll watch a show. You know, they watch 12 1-hour episodes of a TV show or a streaming show, and with no problem. But yeah. You know, try and watch a 6-minute video, and they can't do it.
Yeah, I was told as humans, we only have we only have an expansion of 8 seconds, and the goldfish has 9 seconds. So the goldfish actually beats a human being.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe I'll concentrate on the goldfish market for my video.
Right, and the fish might want to listen. So I want to get into your colors, because you gave me 3 colors for your favorite colors. You gave me paisley,
oh, yeah,
yellow, and pink. So why those 3 colors?
Paisley, because it's evocative of a time and a place, and it's flamboyant and creative and interesting visually. It's not really a color, though, is it? It's more of a design, but I thought I'd stretch the definition a little bit.
Yeah, because I've
never given that color.
So what color is paisley? Is it in the greens and the blues?
It's actually a little bit like this shirt, kind of, you know, these kind of ferny shapes.
Okay.
But it's more tightly packed and complex. But it's more of a pattern than a color, because paisley can be any color.
So, and you gave me yellow and pink too. So why yellow and pink?
Well, yellow, I think, is a very bright in my shirt. Look, it's yellow.
Oh, you see, you got paisley and you got yellow going on. Where's the pink?
Exactly. So I was just describing my shirt. But yellow, I think of as an intellectual color. And I think of it as like a bright, clear color. So I like that about it. It's energetic, it's bright, it's clear, and it's intellectual. And what was the last one?
Pink.
You're not
wearing any pink. I have the pink on.
Pink is a lovely color, don't you think?
I think pink is just a fun color.
Pink is my wife's favorite color. So she has a lot of pink, and I buy pink things for her. But pink is nice. It's soft, it's friendly, it's happy. It's non-controversial, it's non-confrontational. It's not iconoclastic or polemic in any way.
So is your wife opposite of you?
Opposite? No.
No?
Well, not in terms of worldview and outlook. No, we're pretty much in sync.
So I want to get into, before we're wrapping it up there, we're almost at the end. I want to get into Kernel Popcorn.
Kernel Popcorn, yes.
So how did you get with Kernel Popcorn?
Well, he's a local character, and he is a children's performer. And I haven't seen him actually in a long time, but he toured around and he did kids shows, he did magic shows and stuff. Kernel Popcorn, wore a top hat covered in popcorn. And when I was doing the TV show, I did a piece with him because I thought he was an interesting character, and got him to do some more adult stuff. And so we did a 5-minute video. TV show I did was just these little 5-minute sections on artists and performers and people that were doing something interesting, and then we tacked them all together into a half hour show. But it was fun. It was called Alternating Currents, exploring the soft eccentric underbelly of the Victoria art scene.
Oh,
yeah, it was a legendary show.
Yeah, because when I first seen Kernel Popcorn, I was like, that's not the popcorn. Because there is Kernel Popcorn out there, and I was like, no, I gotta get
Kernel, as in you know, one notch above sergeant.
So is that like when was Kernel Popcorn created?
When? I have no idea. I met him about 30 years ago, and then he disappeared into obscurity. So we don't know. If you're out there, Kernel, let us know that you're all right. Give us a sign. Let's see if we can get him onto the chat.
You just never know, right? Miracles happen.
Where are you, Kernel Popcorn? Let's start a campaign. Find out what happened to him.
Yeah, and I also had that you worked with Local Hero International Screen Festival, your House of Cards film.
Yeah, I made a short film called House of Cards, which was shot in 16mm. And I took it around to the film festivals. And that was in an effort to, garner interest and potentially money to make a feature film. So I had 2 feature-length screenplays that I wrote and was trying to produce, and took the short film around the short film festivals and had lots of meetings with different production partners and and producers and stuff to try and get these films made. And came pretty close on one of them, but no cigar. But the film was well received. It won a couple of prizes. Was invited to Local Heroes Film Festival in Edmonton. And they flew me out there and I showed the film and did some talks and stuff. And at the same festival was a retrospective of Werner Herzog, one of my great film heroes and one of the finest filmmakers on the planet. So that was really the high point of my entire film career, was being at that festival and having breakfast with Werner Herzog. After that, it was all downhill.
So, Jimmy, do you have any plans on making any new films in 2024? Is there anything that we should be looking out for?
Oh, yeah, you should be waiting with bated breath for my 27-minute black and white music video accompanying my 27-minute composition, which will be in black and white and high contrast with lots of effects. You'll barely be able to make out what's going on the street. It's going to be very obscure and underground.
But I'm going to. Is that why you gave me this black and white photo of you, Jimmy?
Yeah, my video is going to look like that.
Oh, cool.
It's going to sort of look like that photograph.
So you're really going to get our minds attached.
That's right. Going to blow your minds, man. Strap in.
We're all going to have that moment.
The piece is called No Regrets, and it will be coming up on my YouTube channel under Jimmy Fritz YouTube channel. And you can see 24 music videos and my original songs and some short films and some documentary. And it's all there for the viewing. Leave me a comment.
Your YouTube channel, it has everything on there?
Has a lot of stuff on there, yeah. But my website has everything on there. The YouTube channel doesn't have the books and stuff. So if you want to get everything Jimmy Fritz, you're going to go to jimmyfritz.ca. That's jimmyfritz.ca.
So, Jimmy, what books do you have available?
What books do I have available? Oh, I have Rave Culture and Insider's Overview, a global overview of the rave phenomenon. That was my first book. My second book was Confessions of an Ethical Drug Dealer by Jimmy Fritz. Available at fine bookstores everywhere. And the last one, and the best thing I've ever written, The End of Everything. My wife, Virginia, does all the artwork, by the way. Look at that.
Oh, wow.
It's fantastic, isn't it? Look at the detail in that, baby.
So you guys work together as a partner?
We work together as a team constantly for 45 years.
Well, that's awesome.
It is awesome.
We don't see that many in today's world, 45 years. My grandparents were 60 years. So you don't see that every day.
You don't see it every day.
No, you don't. So, Jimmy, if anybody wanted to reach out to you to have them on your podcast or other platforms, where could they reach you?
JimmyFritz.ca. That's JimmyFritz.ca.
And what final message do you have for everybody today?
Be happy, be free, don't sweat the small stuff, and no brain, no headache.
Awesome. Well, I had a real pleasure having you here today, and I learned a lot from you, so thank you again. I always like having these deep intellectual conversations and learn a little bit from each of my guests. We will be back at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time with Dr. Catherine Hayes, and she'll be in and she'll be talking about her new book as well that was launched, I believe, yesterday. So we'll see if she has any news on that, on where it ranked and how it went. Again, if anybody would like to know more about Tea Time with Miss Liz, check out Miss Liz's website at www.missliz'steatime.com. And if you'd like to sponsor or support Miss Liz in any way, you can make a donation on the website as well. If you'd like to know more about what Miss Liz is all about, you can check out Miss Liz's Facebook page. All of that good stuff is in there. But again, check out Jimmy Fritz and check out his books. Go out to over to his website, check out, and get ready for the 27-minute album that is coming out. It's going to be a blast. It's going to blow our minds, as Jimmy
Brace said. Yourselves.
So again, I want to thank everybody for tuning in. Thank you for all the supporters and audience and listeners out there. If you're just learning about Miss Liz, spread the word. and spill the tea, and let's all make a good old big mess together. And I'll see everybody at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for the second tea time of this week, and we'll close up February all together.
Cheers.